This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the mind chamber where you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. Usually, we take 28 minutes. Not this time. In a matter of days, Britain will be totally out of the EU. So this week, in an hour-long special, we ask, Brexit, is it oven ready yet?
The British people need to have their say on our membership of the EU.
Brexit means Brexit.
We would be perfectly OK if we weren't able to get an agreement, but I'm sure that we will.
The EU knows that we mean business. They know that we are planning for a no-deal scenario.
What we want is a bespoke outcome. We'll probably start with the best of Canada and the best of Japan and the best of South Korea. Canada plus, plus, plus is well, probably plus, plus, plus. Will be one way of putting it.
If we crash out without a deal, the people who have least are going to be hurt most.
If I voted to leave the European Union, would I rather stay in the EU or accept the Chequers proposal? For me, that's a bit of a no-brainer.
We do want to withdraw the agreement, but the backstop will have to change.
The way to deliver Brexit and avoid a no deal is to focus all our energies and time on getting a revised deal.
Let's get this thing done. We've got an oven-ready deal. Put it in the microwave.
The interminable and rather bad-tempered dance that has been the Brexit process is about to come to an end. The music will soon stop to reveal no deal or some fairly minimal deal starting in a matter of days. There will be much shouting. But whatever the rights or wrongs of the business, I want to know two things. What's actually about to happen to us, and are we ready for it? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Over the next hour, we're going to look at different sectors of the economy and society in turn to find out how prepared they are for January the 1st. For the bulk of the programme, I'm joined by two seasoned, almost grizzled experts on the Brexit negotiations. Peter Foster is public policy editor at the Financial Times and author of the FT's weekly Brexit briefing. At the FT, and before that at the Telegraph, he's followed every twist and turn of the negotiations. Jill Rutter is a senior research fellow at the policy think tank The UK in a Changing Europe. She also spent many years in Whitehall as a senior civil servant. She knows where governments like to bury their bodies. Jill Rutter, before we get into the detail of any of this, I think it would be quite good if you could set the scene for us with just how big a moment this moment actually is.
It's pretty big. It's going to determine the shape of our future relationship. We spent years talking about the terms on which we would withdraw from the EU, and that was just settling, if you like, a few big outstanding issues, including Northern Ireland. But this really sets the terms for the UK's future relationship with our nearest neighbour and our biggest trading partner.
Peter.
Yes, indeed. It's remarkable, isn't it, that we've been doing this for 4 years, but nothing has actually happened. Well, on January the 1st, things start to happen. One way to look at it is that in 1992, we entered the single market, and over the next 30 years, we developed more and more frictionless trade with the EU. Well, we're about to put those frictions back. We're about to put all that trade back behind the walls, which we spent 30 years dismantling, and that will be, in the first few months at least, that will be tricky.
Thanks, Peter. Let's start with what's likely to happen beginning in January to agriculture and food production under deal or no deal scenarios. To kick us off, we have the view from the farmers.
I'm Minette Batters, President of the National Farmers Union. So a no-deal Brexit is really, really bad news, quite honestly, for British agriculture. We've made the point time and time again that we cannot afford to leave without a deal. And that is primarily because agriculture is traded with such big tariffs. So if I look at our access into the EU, where we export a lot of our lamb, so 30% of what we produce goes into the EU market at a value of £340 million per annum, we'd be looking at a 62% tariff. If we take beef as another example, we're looking at an 85% tariff. Obviously, we export £375 million worth of beef to the EU. Cheddar cheese, a 44% tariff. Barley, a 51% tariff. So you can see that, you know, we are immediately in a no-deal scenario priced out of the European marketplace. On every level for farming, a no-deal scenario is catastrophic. If it is a thin deal, there will be significant costs attached. We're going to have a lot more friction, even with a deal. Friction adds cost. We don't want to see any levels of food inflation. We don't want to see perishable products. Bearing in mind, you know, the only priority is fish and day-old chicks. We've got a vast amount of fresh produce that is coming in through the short straits, Calais into Dover and Dover into Calais. It's a perishable supply chain. So ultimately, you want things to move as fast as possible to avoid any wastage and making sure that those checks can be done seamlessly. All I can see at the moment, even with a thin deal, is cost that is attached. There's a limit to how prepared farmers can be. There is a definite concern around viability of business. Farmers are very concerned about added costs. Ultimately, you know, it is the traders that those costs are going to hit.
Jill Rutter, that's not a comforting picture that Minette Batters depicts there, either way, deal or no deal. Also, either way, how well prepared are the sectors, agriculture, food, retailers, for whatever's going to happen?
Well, as Minette said, this is the area where deal or no deal really makes the biggest difference in terms of prices. If you're a lamb or a beef farmer, you really don't know whether you'll be able to export next year. Obviously, you can divert some of that excess into the UK market because there'd be tariffs on incoming trade. But that's a huge, big uncertainty. And in terms of retailers, I think the big retailers will have been preparing. But what they can't prepare for is disruption at ports. So they can't prepare for, is there going to be a 1-2 day delay in getting across the border? That's going to be a real problem for them in the short run. And that's why we're looking at sort of potential disruption in the first quarter as people get used to the new processes. The UK is basically not imposing full controls until July. So it's going to try and free up our side of the border as far as possible. But in the other direction, if you're an exporter, at the moment, every expectation is that the EU will probably impose something pretty much like full controls going that way. And one of the troubles is if we see large traffic delays, those can be caused by holdups either side of the border.
Peter Foster, if there's no deal, are we likely to see difficulties with getting fresh food from the EU into the UK?
I think there is a risk of shortages of perishable products, particularly in the supermarkets. A lot of our fruit and veg, particularly in the winter, comes from the EU, from the glasshouses of Spain and the Netherlands. And it's contingent on a whole load of human factors as to whether or not, for example, EU hauliers want to come to the UK. I mean, a lot of them don't want to get stuck in traffic jams. They don't want to be liable for perishable products getting out of date on the road. I don't think they will be, you know, leaving the country going hungry. It's more a question of, I think, political embarrassment that Brexit has led to potentially empty shelves in some specific products.
And what about if there is a deal? Presumably, the question of shortages then doesn't arise.
Well, not necessarily. I think it gets easier if there's a deal because a deal will probably contain some easements that will help the roll-on-roll-off traffic, 10,000 trucks a day that come over that short strait between Dover and Calais. It's the kind of pipe that connects us with the EU. And if we get a deal, there are more likely to be easements to make that traffic flow better, but it won't be completely unconstrained.
Jill, what do we think is likely to happen to prices under either a no-deal or a deal scenario?
Well, under a deal, then we won't have tariffs, as Minette was saying, but you know, some of these extra costs could reflect in prices to consumers. But if we look at what happens with no deal, then someone said, well, if you basically applied the common external tariff to imports into the UK, that would add about 4% to food prices. That's the sort of outer limit.
Now, what about the question of higher costs for transferring livestock, animal produce to Britain? Are we likely to see higher costs, Peter, to such transfer?
So, as Minette Batter said, the first is that animal products require a export health certificate from the 1st of January. That is a wet stamp certificate from a vet. Vets don't come cheap. It's not clear that we actually have enough vets to do the stamping. It may also be that all pork needs a trichinella test. We still wait and see what these details are, but at the upper end, there is a significant bureaucratic cost. Then there's haulage cost. If hauliers are going to be stuck during long delays, they will add cost.
Jill, let's talk about seasonal workers. Traditionally, seasonal workers have come from across Europe to pick our fruit and so on. What's been agreed on this for the new year?
What we've had this year is a scheme called the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Scheme. The government actually quadrupled the number of permits under that from 2,500 to 10,000 this year. So I think if you had asked Minette Batter, she would say that the farmers think they need something nearer to sort of 70,000 of those agricultural workers to be given visas. But that's a decision that the farming community is waiting on the UK government for.
Peter, what about fishing? I mean, we know this has been a huge sticking point, despite the fact that the sector is not one of the biggest in the country. But insofar as it is important, is the fishing sector ready for what happens under either deal or no deal?
Fishing products, along with day-old chicks, are one of the very narrow band of products that the government is going to try and give prioritised access to the border so the products don't rot on the docks. So those vehicles will be mustered at Ebb's Fleet, I think, and then given a fast lane to the border. It's one of the sort of ironies about the whole row over fish is that about 70% of the fish that British boats land in the UK get sold into the EU market. So our fishermen want more fish, but the people who process and sell the fish want access to market. And that's what the government will be trying to balance in the fishing deal.
So the outlook for farming and the food industry with a deal is at best uncertain, and with no deal looks rather grim. What about for UK manufacturers? Here's the perspective of the car industry.
I'm Ian Henry, Managing Director and Owner of Auto Analysis. If there is no deal, there will be tariffs not just on the cars that we export, there will be tariffs on the components that UK companies export, there will be tariffs on the cars that come in, there will be tariffs on the components that come in, and that could amount to several billion pounds. The UK government has said that they will impose tariffs of between 2 and 4% on components in the event of no deal, and we know that the tariff on cars would be 10%. That would be 10% of the factory price, not 10% of the retail price. But either way, it will amount to significant amounts of money. If you take the likely production going forward to between now and 2025 in the event of a deal and compare that to the likely production levels if there was no deal, we would have over that period a cumulatively lower production volume of around 2 million vehicles, which would be worth about £55 billion at the factory gate. If we do get a deal, and I do hope we do, it's probably reasonable to say that much of what we have in the UK is sustainable in the medium term. Most of the vehicles that are made in the UK would be continued at broadly the production levels that they're at. The crucial issue is how far the factories, particularly those for Nissan, for Toyota and Vauxhall, now part of the PSA group, will be impacted by Brexit, because they exist primarily to supply the European market. And just over 80% of the output from Toyota goes to Greater Europe, as one might call it. The rest stays here. So those factories with reduced access will become less competitive when supplying the EU. And the other issue is from the point of view of the vehicles that are imported. If the costs of importing and the administrative processes and so forth become too onerous, there could well be cases where car companies say, well, for some vehicles, it's not worth making them a right-hand drive for the UK. Consumers could see a reduced range available, and that may not be what many consumers are expecting.
Ian Henry. Jill Rutter, Ian talked there about the hit to car companies if tariffs are going to be added. What happens if parts of a car that we wish to export are made in countries outside of the EU?
That's a real issue in these negotiations, the so-called rules of origin. So rules of origin are the rules that they have to say, well, we might do a preferential trade deal with you, UK, but we only want that to apply to goods that have sufficient UK content to count as UK goods. Otherwise, you could imagine that people might just sort of send their goods on a stop-off point in the UK and use that as a base to export into the EU, round-tripping to benefit from the UK's trade deal. So the EU traditionally insists on a pretty high proportion of local content. But the problem is a lot of the components for UK cars come not from the EU, but from other places, South Korea or Japan. So the question is, will they be able to count that content? That's absolutely critical for some companies. Those companies that have a lot of non-EU components will need much more generous rules of origin than the EU conventionally allows.
Jill, as far as we understand it, whatever is decided, are the companies actually ready for it? I mean, can they deal with the change?
These are big companies, so they will, we assume, be able to comply with those rules of origin procedures, document their supply chains and things like that. I think the thing that that a lot of companies are really worried about, and this was part of the thinking behind Theresa May's Chequers deal, was they are worried about potential holdups. A lot of these companies operate with what are called just-in-time supply chains. So they assume that they have very little warehousing capacity. They assume that they can have goods just coming over the border, those components coming in, and turn them around really, really quickly in their assembly plants. And I think that's a big thing that they can't manage and predict at this moment.
Peter, we tend to use the car industry as a kind of emblem of all manufacturing sectors. But let's think about the others as well. Engineering, electronics, pharmaceuticals. As far as we know, how prepared are they either for a deal or a no deal?
So the bigger companies are reasonably well prepared, but UK manufacturing is actually quite an intermediate sector, so it's highly connected to a lot of European supply chains. So a chemical, for example, might go 3 or 4 times back and forth across the channel in the process of being made into a final product. And the UK is now going to find itself a weak link in those supply chains. And I think the worry is that over time, those supply chains will corrode because it will just become easier to use single market substitutes. It doesn't mean that it's going to become impossible to trade. Of course it's not. It just means that at the margin, where there's an alternative within the single market, UK businesses are certainly fearful that they're going to lose out.
So how much extra bureaucracy does it involve?
The government keeps on producing these border operating model diagrams and goes through those things. And they sort of typically seem to have about sort of 12 or 13 stages in them if you look through these flowcharts. It's much more if you are in what's called a highly regulated sector. So if you've talked about pharmaceuticals or chemicals, those will have more processes to leap through. And one of the problems for businesses is that whereas before a UK authority could basically license you or approve you for the whole of the EU, in the future, unless the UK gets something that it's asking for called mutual recognition of conformity assessment, the EU won't recognise that sort of licensing by the UK. So people will have to double up on those approvals processes.
Peter Foster, how prepared are UK ports for all the checks that are going to be required, deal or no deal?
The ports themselves, I think, are reasonably ready if the hauliers are ready, if the people using the ports are ready. And that's where the problem comes in, because the flow diagrams that Jill talks about need to be translated into the mines, into the cabs, into the business processes of the people who operate and trade. And these are often small businesses. And what they need to do is reasonably complex. In fact, can't be done without the help often of professionals. So they're in short supply. And that's where this constraint's going to come.
Now, you know what's coming next, the Kent Access Permit. Is it ready to be rolled out? And how do you get one if you're a lorry driver? How does it work? And what do you think the consequences of it will be?
It is ready. Essentially, it's an honesty box. It just asks the haulier, what's your number plate? And do you have the correct documentation? And it takes you through, are you carrying goods of animal origin? Do you have a health certificate? Do you have that? And you tick all the boxes. And if you do, then it says, here's your permit, off you go. It's designed to try and stop people getting to the border without the necessary documentation that's going to give them the barcode, that's going to get them on the ferry, that's going to keep the trucks rolling. One of the problems is that 85% of the trucks coming across the short straits are driven by EU hauliers. And I was down in Ashford in a truck park only a couple of weeks ago. And I can tell you that mostly they're Polish, Romanian, Czech, Hungarian, and they don't speak a word of English. So until the Europeans also ingest the Kent Access Permit and explain to their drivers they're going to need it, that will also just mean that, you know, there's more accidents waiting to happen. And that's what people fear.
Thank you. It takes two to stop tangoing. So how do things look now from the EU side?
My name is Marcel Fratscher. I'm the president of the German Institute for Economic Research, a research institute and think tank in Berlin, and professor for macroeconomics at Humboldt University. If there is a deal on Brexit, it would mean that German European companies can keep continuing most of their business with UK companies. Not all of it, but most of it. Clearly not in all areas will the trade be uninterrupted. But if there is a deal, I hope that this impact will be relatively small. If there was no deal on Brexit, I fear that we might have disruptions for German companies. It would add to the costs. It would add to a lot of uncertainty. Overall, I think the economic impact would be relatively small for the German economy. They cannot avoid all the costs that no deal comes with. It would mean higher prices for consumers. So it would have a significant cost for the German economy, even though overall this probably would not be visible. So to most consumers, they would not realize that there are these problems. A no deal would mean that particular industry, particularly the car manufacturers, 12% of the German car manufacturers' exports go to the UK. Also, the producers of machinery and also pharmaceuticals would be affected. And this impact could rise over time, because if there are different regulatory standards, if the UK says we have different rules and different regulations in the UK compared to the European Union, it will make it even harder for German companies to trade with the UK. The cost will be higher for the UK. But still, for German companies, the price is significant. Politicians will have to find a way to make this work, because no company really can prepare perfectly well for such a scenario that we will experience with the 31st of December.
Marcel Fratscher. From what Marcel just said, an awful lot from the European point of view hinges on regulation being and staying broadly the same across the EU and the people it does business with. Is there any sign that we're going to reach an agreement on this?
This is one of the core questions to the entire negotiation. The EU wants what it calls a level playing field. It wants the rules to ensure that we have free and fair competition. But of course, Brexit, on one level, is about divergence. And I think Brexiteers have often said, because the EU runs a big surplus in goods, the German car industry is reliant on the UK, it will do a deal that accommodates our desire to diverge. But that misunderstands the kind of balance of power, which is the UK is indeed an important German export destination, but it's the fifth largest. If you add all the other 26 EU markets, they're worth about eight times what the Germans export to the UK. And so Germany's never going to do a deal. Angela Merkel's never going to do a deal that undermines Germany and EU companies where their bread is mostly still buttered. That's where the central tension of the talks comes in. In terms of regulation, the UK, because it's defined Brexit as an exercise in sovereignty, has decided simply to create parallel regulatory regimes. So we're not going to have the CE mark, we're going to have a UK CA mark. We're not going to use the EU's REACH chemicals database, and chemicals go in everything from hair care to car paints to everything. We're going to have these parallel regulatory systems. And again, that just creates a wall between us and the single market, with whom we do about half our trade. You always have to remember that a German car maker has 26 other choices inside the regulatory envelope that is the single market to choose from if it wants to reorientate its supply chains. And that's the danger to the British car industry, to British manufacturers, that it finds itself at a marginal disadvantage by putting itself behind a whole load of regulatory barriers.
Now, one push on that question a bit is the question of state aid, which seems like a paradoxical question, because you wouldn't have thought a government like this one would particularly want to give that much state aid, and yet it's been a problem. Can you explain very briefly why and whether you think we're going to resolve it?
The state aid regime is actually an EU regime, and it's born of the fact that the EU has a single market made of 27 sovereign states. And so you need a state aid regime in order to make sure that there's fair competition between the two. The British argument, again, is a question of sovereignty. The British argument is we're now an independent state, a sovereign state, and so we won't be dictated to by the EU to have an equivalent mirroring regime that requires us to notify the regulator before we give any subsidies. We want a free hand. We're a free country. The problem is that the EU says, well, that's fine, you can do what you like, but if you want zero tariff, zero quota access to our market of 460 million people, we want guarantees that you're not going to unfairly subsidise your businesses to undercut ours. And so whether or not they can agree on a state aid or subsidy regime equal on both sides, or whether or not they have to agree some kind of retaliatory governance mechanism that gives the EU confidence that if the UK does undercut it, it can hit back in a timely fashion before its businesses have gone under, then I think we'll struggle to get a deal.
Jill, if there is a deal, how would regulatory alignment be enforced on the other side of the EU? I mean, how are they going to try and do it?
Well, that's, of course, the big question, because this is an area where the starting point for the two sides was absolutely miles apart. The UK really didn't want very much in the way of enforcement. It wanted big areas to which there was no dispute settlement, just some sort of provisions to talk, basically, if one side was worried about what the other was doing. The EU wanted a big battery of potential enforcement. And one of the other big differences between the UK and the EU, where the UK does seem to have moved a bit, been on what's called governance. The UK started out saying, actually, we don't want one all-singing, all-dancing comprehensive agreement. We'd like a lot of different agreements. And any sort of retaliation would be confined to the terms of that agreement. So if we had a row about fish, you could take action on fish, but you couldn't take action on aviation or on trade in goods. The EU said, no, we want one single deal and we want the ability to cross-retaliate so that if the UK offends in one area, then the EU could take action in another. What we would probably see is much more of a sort of ad hoc panel arrangement. So if there's a dispute to be settled, you'd get an arrangement whereby the UK would nominate some arbitrators, the EU would nominate some arbitrators, there might be somebody who is seen as an independent chair to make those decisions. And that's much more common in free trade agreements.
So, much clarity on level playing fields yet required. For you and I, one of the biggest areas of change is travel. So how will things alter when we travel to the EU after January the 1st? And are we all ready?
I'm Chris Morris, the BBC's Reality Check correspondent. And whether there's a trade deal or not, a lot is going to change for people travelling to the EU from the 1st of January. That's because the government has decided to leave the single market, end free movement of people, and introduce a new immigration system. And restrictions on immigration and other things cut both ways. So here's a few new rules to keep in mind. You'll need to make sure your passport is valid for 6 months from your date of travel to the EU, apart from Ireland, which is a special case as part of the common travel area with Northern Ireland. You'll no longer be able to join the EU queue at ports and airports. It's the rest of the world queue from now on. Pet passports will no longer be valid, so if you want to take your dog or any other pet across the channel, the advice is you need to contact your vet about 4 months before you want to go. The government has applied for some exemptions, but we still don't know if it'll get any. The current EHIC health insurance card is going, which means you should think about taking out travel insurance unless you're already living elsewhere in the EU before the end of this year. As for driving, you may need an international driving permit. That varies from country to country. And you may need a green card to show you have insurance. Again, the UK is hoping for a green card exemption, but we don't know if it'll get one. The guarantee that there'll be no mobile phone roaming charges comes to an end, but the good news is that the UK's four biggest mobile operators have all said they have no plan to bring back roaming charges. Now, you won't need a visa for short-term visits or holidays, but from 2022, you will need to pay online for a cheap visa waiver. And in most European countries, those in the passport-free Schengen area, you'll only be allowed to stay for 90 days in every 180-day period. Some British newspapers have been running articles about how unreasonable this is for people with second homes abroad, but the EU hasn't changed its rules. It's the UK that has chosen to diverge. Need a drink after all of that? Well, people travelling to the EU from England, Scotland and Wales will be able to take advantage of duty-free shopping again from the beginning of next year.
Chris Morris. Peter, before we come into some of the more detailed questions, this really is a biggie. Freedom of movement is about to end. Do you think in general, psychologically and in other ways, we're ready for that?
No, you know, we said right at the beginning that this is 4 years of debate where nothing's actually happened. Well, the losing of free movement is going to be, I think, one of the things that people feel most keenly. Longer queues at the airport, they'll no longer be able to go and live, work, study at the drop of a hat in another EU country. And if you're doing what they call mode four, fly-in, fly-out services, you're going to find yourself tangling with the national regime. So if you're a model going to do a shoot in Berlin, you're no longer going to be able to go to pop to Berlin, do a shoot, and then pop to Milan and do a shoot. You're going to have to conform with the nation states. Individual requirements for providing services in those states. And so I think that will be one of the ways in which Brexit actually comes home for a lot of people as they go about their ordinary lives.
Now, how long can you stay in the EU once you are there? And how long, if you're from the EU, can you stay here under a deal or under a no deal? Jill.
So I think the UK is a bit more liberal. I think we let people come in for longer. But obviously, if you want to come and work, you've lost freedom of movement. So you'll need to apply for one of the new work visas in the points-based system that the Home Office has just launched. If you're a UK person who wants to go to the EU, the rules there are that, whereas at the moment we can just go and spend how much time we like, that you can only spend 90 days in any 180 days.
Peter, what happens if I am an EU national with a UK job offer which is starting in February or March? What exactly do I now need to do?
If you're an EU national with a job offer next year, you're going to need to go through the UK immigration system. And broadly, that requires you to follow the same rules that non-EU citizens do. So it's a points-based system. So you need to make a skills or a salary threshold in order to get a sponsorship via the company that's employing you.
Now, I imagine that this has a knock-on effect for the British companies that wish to employ such people, which is they're now going to have to factor that process in a way that they didn't before.
If you're reliant on EU citizens to move quickly to do your business, then life just got a lot more complicated.
Now, Jill, what about British nationals who have married or have a spouse from the EU? Will they be able to return home with their spouse, no problems like before?
Over time, they'll find that they will be caught by the income threshold that applies now to a British citizen who marries somebody who's not from the EU. So the real worry, I think, for quite a lot of British citizens in the EU who don't think they'll meet that earnings threshold is if they need to return home at some point, that they won't be able to bring their spouse with them.
Peter, let's look at aviation. Are we going to have full reciprocal travel rights? And if not, what does that mean for flights and for costs of flights?
Broadly speaking, I think the British government says that even in a no deal, and the European Commission has given a fairly clear signal on this, the planes will keep flying. There may be some issues on low-cost airlines flying between EU cities, but I think they will be fairly minimal. After a deal, we will have to negotiate bilateral open skies agreements between individual countries to deepen our relationships with those individual countries.
Finally, on student exchange schemes, will there be special visas for students, for example, on the Erasmus scheme, Jill?
Well, at the moment, we don't know whether the UK wants to go on participating in Erasmus. There are separate discussions going on about UK participation in EU programmes. That's one of the strands in the talks. But the UK has said that on all of these things, it will make a judgment about whether its value for money to go on participating. I think the UK wants to be relatively liberal on student visas, students to come here. So I think we'll probably see some sorts of agreements on student mobility, because I think both sides would agree it's worthwhile to have students from one country studying in another. The problem that UK students may face and that EU students coming here will face is that at the moment you're supposed to treat EU students in the same way as you do your domestic students. So it's likely that the much higher international fees will kick in.
Again, a big difference for us between deal and no deal. Now, services, including what goes on in the City of London, which make up a huge part of Britain's economy, they've hardly got any attention during this long, long process. But are they ready for Brexit?
I'm Sarah Hall. I'm a professor of economic geography at the University of Nottingham. The UK relies on financial services to a much greater extent than other similar economies. It accounts for around 7% of our economic output, about 3% of jobs. Crucially, much of the outcome of the Brexit trade negotiations actually won't impact financial services directly. Trade negotiations typically don't do very much for services, and that's certainly true of these trade talks. The financial services sector has known for some time that they had to move from passporting. That means that a firm can access the EU from the UK without additional regulations and licensing requirements, to what's known as equivalence. So from the 1st of January, UK financial services firms will be reliant on equivalence decisions to access the EU single market. And these decisions are made when the EU determines that UK regulation is equivalent to EU regulation. Under a deal scenario, I think there are more areas where we might see equivalence decisions being made, particularly around share trading, for example. A no-deal outcome would be important because it would set a political tone for the two parties, which may make working collaboratively in the future more difficult. So in a no-deal scenario, I think it is less likely that some areas of financial services would receive equivalence decisions. We could see less favourable decisions being made about questions like, how is the EU going to view fund management that continues to take place within London, with these firms only having kind of shell offices within the EU, for example. Under the EU equivalence regime, it can withdraw equivalence within 30 days. And that gives really significant uncertainty to UK firms if their sort of level of market access to the EU can be withdrawn in that short period of time.
Sarah Hall. Peter, financial services haven't broadly been in the frame of the talks at all. Is this going to be all about last-minute deals and ad hoc arrangements, or what you call easements and upsides?
I think we will have to wait and see how long it takes the Commission to div these unilateral equivalence deals, where it just says on its own merits the two regulatory systems are equivalents and that gives access to the market. This is a sort of fragmenting event. The end of passporting essentially creates two markets, an EU market and a UK market, and that's going to have a series of consequences. I think it'll make capital markets more expensive and more French in the EU. It'll be tough for investment and retail banking. We wait and see whether asset management, whether you can manage funds in New York and London when they're domiciled, say, in Luxembourg, that will be a bigger hit. We've seen about 7,500 jobs go across to the EU, according to EY, the consultancy. That's about 4% of city jobs. And then we're going to have to wait and see over time, creating these two separate markets, the extent to which it erodes the city as a business. Remember, the city is a global centre. So in things like fintech,
financial tech
and green tech investing, you just have such big quorums of expertise and investment that the city is likely to hold its ground in those areas. It's a global financial centre, and actually the really big shifts in terms of share listings of big companies, raising money, a lot of that's going on in Asia now in a way that it wasn't before. So the city is actually under pressure from the fact that these financial capital raisings can be done in Asia in a way that they weren't a decade ago. And that's actually changing the city's role, its place in the world, probably more indeed than Brexit will.
Jill, one of the things which eases the capacity to do work across borders is will we recognise each other's professional qualifications and standards and so on. Is that going to carry on as far as we know?
We don't think so. That was one of the UK's asks. The UK said it was only asking for what was in other trade deals. One of the areas where it was asking for a bit more and was accused of cherry picking was on what's called mutual recognition of professional qualifications. That means that if you're UK qualified, say as an architect, that qualification is recognised throughout the EU. The EU's said no to that. I don't expect even in a thin deal we'll get that. So then there might be some scope for some sort of bilateral cooperative agreements. We've already seen some companies registering their staff, putting them through Irish qualifications, though quite interestingly, the Irish Law Society equivalent was complaining and saying actually you had to be sort of doing business and have some sort of attachment to Ireland. I think they were saying rather than just be people who sort of paid a cheque and got an Irish qualification. So we might see some more of that, but it's undoubtedly going to be a barrier.
Peter, finally, are we essentially talking here about a long-term process? In other words, whatever happens as a result of deal or no deal in the financial sector is not something we will fully understand for some years to come.
I think that's absolutely right, and that's true actually across all of Brexit. We wait and see the extent to which, for example, individual member states enforce their immigration regimes for British service professionals going in and out of Europe to provide their services. You know, structurally, we wait and see whether or not the European Union can claw back euro clearing from the city. It's been trying to do that for the last 5 years, not had much success. Will Brexit make a big difference? Well, the last 4 years haven't made a huge difference. So, again, we wait and see the extent to which the barriers that we are about to recreate between us and that market of 460 million people reorientates our trade, and it will do so in ways, I think, that, you know, are not now being predicted.
So, no revolutions in services are imminent and change will be incremental. A second area which has been given arguably less attention in coverage of Brexit is that of national security. Will we be less safe after we leave the EU, given the amount of coordination that currently goes on with EU authorities and the access we have to their databases?
I'm Julian King, and until the end of 2019, I was the British European Commissioner, responsible for the Security Union. If there's a deal, there will be a dialed-down relationship compared with what we've had in recent years as a member and during the transition period, but still worthwhile having. It'll be possible to find ways of reproducing some of the working relationships that police, law enforcement, those on the front line, whether they're law enforcement officers, border guards, immigration officers, use to do their daily job to keep us safe. So you'd be able to rebuild some of the links with the European Police Agency, Europol, and the prosecution agency, Eurojust. You'd be able to rebuild access to some of the law enforcement databases and data sharing arrangements that have become so important to practitioners. If there's no deal, I'm afraid that we face the prospect of being disconnected from those EU networks and those information systems and databases, essentially being unplugged at the end of the year, no longer able to participate in those European agencies, getting a full stop in various judicial cooperation procedures. And unless there's some sort of alternative arrangement, there's a risk that UK information that's been shared across those different networks and databases that's held in other countries in Europe will have to be deleted because there'll no longer be a valid legal basis for those countries holding UK sourced information. The security services in the UK and in other European partner countries have been discussing what they can do to try and manage the situation. A lot of their plans are based on the prospect of a deal and being able to work around the arrangements that exist at the moment for links between these different police agencies, these different databases and information sharing networks.
Peter Foster, what Julian King has outlined there, firstly, has a very big difference between no deal and deal. No deal means essentially unplugged. But even deal means you lose access to the Schengen database. And he's used the term several times there, real challenge. Could we begin to try and quantify what the real challenge actually is? I mean, what difference might this make on the day-to-day safety of UK citizens?
Well, I think, you know, it will be really interesting, the politics, the first time we see potentially a crime committed by a European national who perhaps shouldn't have been in the country had we been connected to the Schengen information system, the European arrest warrant, the big overarching information sharing systems that were created under EU membership, and which, you know, a lot of Brexiteers resisted. In fact, you know, Theresa May was the Home Secretary, took us into a lot of these things against the wish of those who became ardent Brexiteers. But, you know, that is going to be, I think, one of the interesting political moments if we do start to see crimes committed by those who would otherwise have been arguably caught as a result of the European systems.
Jill, one of the almost kind of cynical suggestions you could make here is because that would be intolerable, that governments will discover ways of working around it, that they will create informal modes of cooperation which will supersede these formal cooperative ties. Is that actually possible?
Well, there's a network of sort of international conventions that predate the sort of creation, if you like, of the sort of Justice and Home Affairs Union, which is relatively late to the EU, sort of came after the single market and things like that. So there are a bunch of old conventions you can fall back on, but they're quite clunky. They're not really that fitted to a world in which crime is very much a sort of cross-border, networked, digital activity, all those sorts of things there. So they could be informal cooperation. The other thing that they could do is we talk a lot about no deal and what happens with no deal. I think the interesting thing about security is that this is an area where it really is inordinately in both sides' interests to try and make the arrangements work as well as they can. There'll be constraints. Julian King mentioned constraints on, you know, if you've won't like creating precedents for the UK, but I think it would be really interesting to see, even if there were no deal, down the line, this might be an area where you could do some sort of separate agreement between the UK and the EU. It's all been wrapped up in the trade talks. Doesn't necessarily need to have been wrapped up in the trade talks, because just as Peter said, there's a big downside for the UK, but the UK is a very major information supplier into all these systems. EU countries benefit a lot from having the UK networked in. So I think it is an area where there is, you could argue, much more symmetry of mutual benefit and disbenefit in trying to find future arrangements. And that's particularly acute in Northern Ireland. Naomi Long, the Justice Minister in Northern Ireland, made the comment that while a deal on trade was very important for Northern Ireland, a deal on security was absolutely essential for Northern Ireland.
Again, here, no deal is suboptimal, but there are clear potential consequences even if we have a deal. Of course, the UK's security situation will be affected by what happens in Northern Ireland once we've left the EU. And there are economic consequences too.
My name is Peter Taylor. I've been reporting on and covering the events in Northern Ireland for 50 years now. As far as Northern Ireland is concerned, the overriding issue of Brexit is how to avoid a hard border that would undermine the Good Friday Agreement and potentially take us back to the dark days of the Troubles. This, however, I think is unlikely to happen, as no party, be it British, Irish or EU, wishes that to happen. So a compromise had to be reached as part of the withdrawal agreement of 2019. It was in the form of a Northern Irish Protocol that effectively placed Northern Ireland within the EU single market, with checks being carried out at Northern Irish ports of entry. Effectively, this placed the border in the Irish Sea, something that Boris Johnson said would never happen. He was supported in this by many of his MPs and by unionists in Northern Ireland, as they saw it as weakening the union between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. But the government then created its own get-out-of-jail-free card by drafting the Internal Market Bill, now on its way to becoming law. This would allow the government to change some of the things it didn't like about the Northern Ireland Protocol. The impact of a trade deal would seem fairly straightforward, as goods and services would flow pretty seamlessly, with Northern Ireland effectively being in the EU single market. If there's a no deal, if the government decides to drive a coach and horses through the Northern Ireland Protocol by triggering the Internal Market Act, then the outlook is much bleaker and potentially more dangerous in terms of community relations, with the prospect of some kind of hard border rearing its head again. The problem is that next year marks the centenary of partition, the legislation that actually divided the island, and to many people that's what the root of the troubles is. The last thing Northern Ireland needs is a no-deal Brexit being thrown into the already combustible mix.
Peter Taylor. For this section, we've invited two Northern Ireland specialists to discuss how far the region is prepared for Brexit and what might happen next. They're Katie Hayward, Professor of Political Sociology at Queen's University Belfast, and Tony Connolly, Europe Editor for RTE News and Current Affairs. Tony and Katie, I want to come to Peter's last big point later. But Tony, can we begin with the concrete here? Either with a deal or with a no deal, will there be a tariffs custom checks imposed on goods or livestock coming from GB, the Great Britain, to Northern Ireland?
If there's a deal, there won't be any tariffs on goods coming over from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. But there still will be customs formalities. You'll still have to make a customs declaration. And there will be some fairly onerous checks and controls on consignments of food coming over from Great Britain. Live animals at the moment coming in from Great Britain already face some checks and controls. But once the protocol takes effect on the 1st of January, then a lot of the formalities will extend to all kinds of food, especially food of animal origin. And there is a very laborious process going on between the UK and the European Union to try and mitigate that effect as far as possible. And it's not been easy because the UK is effectively trying to whittle down those checks as far as they can, whereas the EU is saying, hang on a second, we have to protect our internal market. We can't just give you a carte blanche to bring in whatever you want into Northern Ireland. There is a process underway to try and make life manageable for people, but it is still fraught with potential difficulties and potential price rises and possibly even certain products not being available in Northern Ireland supermarkets.
I just want to understand who it is faces the problems of those mitigations or lack of mitigation.
Well, in Northern Ireland, if you are importing food, then you must make sure that the food is subject to EU food safety controls. As far as I'm aware, it's the exporter of the food that will have to make sure those formalities are met. And there's what they call export health certificates, which have to be signed off by a vet, and someone has to pick up the charge of that particular procedure. There are a range of other problem areas. If there is no deal and if there are tariffs, then somebody will have to pay the tariff. If the EU tariff is higher than a UK tariff, these problems are going to hit exporters and importers, and especially people in the food business and in the live animal business.
Now, Katie Hayward, what Tony's talked about there are a series of situations, all of which require actions and preparations. From your understanding, are those mechanisms now in place and do people understand how to use them?
Because the EU has been very clear that the protocol will have to be fully operational by the 1st of January, the UK decided that it was going to essentially trial some new mechanisms for movement of goods moving from GB into NI. So these include a trader support service, goods vehicle movement service, the customs declaration service. We don't have any of these properly piloted yet. The trader support service, which is fundamental to all of this, isn't due to go live until the 21st of December. Although there's a lot of messaging, necessarily so, about the change that's going to happen for goods moving from Britain into the EU, there is concern over here in Northern Ireland that the message hasn't got through, that many of those issues will apply from goods moving from GB into NI.
Tony, let's talk about ports. I mean, are we ready there?
Well, the ports in Northern Ireland are not ready, and that's been publicly admitted by the Northern Ireland Civil Service. That's partly because the Northern Ireland Civil Service couldn't really move on starting their preparations until they got a clear signal from London as to how the UK government was going to implement the protocol. And that only happened in May when the British government published its so-called command paper on implementing the protocol. And it was only from then that the authorities in Northern Ireland could see what legal framework and what physical framework they were going to have to get into to start building border control posts. That those are for dealing with live animals and products of animal origin. On the GB side, there is going to be a requirement that officials in ports like Cairn Ryan, Heysham and Liverpool will do some electronic checks and controls on food products that are leaving Great Britain and heading over on the ferry to Belfast or Larne or Warren Point. Mm.
Katie, Peter Taylor's last point in his presentation was a more amorphous point about the impact politically on the Good Friday Agreement of all this happening, not least in the centenary of partition. Are you worried?
I mean, for a long time, we've been very aware of the fact that the peace process is very fragile and the Good Friday Agreement is fragile. And it's very much based on a good British-Irish relationship and on a workable relationship of trust between unionists and nationalists and others in Northern Ireland. And on almost all fronts, there's a sense of insecurity and uncertainty about the future. And in such an environment, yes, people are worried about the peace process, primarily because of all of this uncertainty and the pressures that are going to come on the power-sharing assembly.
Katie and Tony, thanks for joining us. Our hour is practically up, but before I let Peter and Jill go, I have one more question. I want to just get us to think a little bit more long-term. I mean, the EU grew up around us and things and relationships developed that we didn't necessarily foresee. I was wondering what you think we might see change or develop over the long term as a result of leaving the EU in this kind of matrix of relationships. Peter?
Yes, I think, you know, we've discussed the short-term disruption, but over the medium term, I think we are going to drift away from the EU. I think it's almost inevitable that we will find ourselves in a fairly grinding, frictional relationship, a bit like the one that the Swiss have, that will force British industry, British society probably, to over time orientate away from the EU, perhaps more towards America, more towards an international outlook. And from a purely economic perspective, it's not at all clear that the upsides of that will offset the downsides of erecting barriers between us and the advanced economies on our doorstep.
Jill, what do you think?
I think it's interesting. I mean, one question we haven't touched on is how the UK government proposes to use its new freedom to diverge. As Peter said, that's been a big theme, that they want to have that, but we don't know what that's going to look like. I mean, do they actually have really big ideas? We've only really seen that on agriculture policy, where we're going to replace the common agricultural policy. I think most people would agree that actually that is one area where the UK definitely ought to be able to do better. We've been very frustrated by that.
My thanks to Jill Rutter, Peter Foster, Katie Hayward, Tony Connolly and all our individual contributors. We'll be back at the same time again next week. Bye-bye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Serena Tarling and Sally Abrahams. The programme was mixed by James Beard and the editor was Jasper Corbett. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, but if you enjoyed it, you may find other episodes interesting, including Is Britain Broke?, Should We Have Exams Next Year? And The Migrant Situation. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.